I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's April 5th, and we have a lot to talk about. And today we're talking about a treatment for MS that we don't often hear about. But for some people living with MS, hypnosis has proven to be effective in managing the chronic pain that often accompanies multiple sclerosis. Joining me to help us better understand how and why hypnosis should be given careful consideration when you're thinking about symptom management is Dr. Mark Jensen. Dr. Jensen is a professor and vice chair of the Department of Rehabilitation Medicine at the University of Washington. He's devoted his career to the development and evaluation of effective pain treatments with a focus on hypnotic interventions. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Mark Jensen, there are a few other things that you should know about. Our brain and spinal cord are protected from microscopic organisms or dangerous substances that can travel in our bloodstream by a membrane called the blood-brain barrier. This membrane is made up of highly specialized cells that line the very tiny blood vessels in our brain. And the blood-brain barrier is extremely good at doing its job of preventing substances from crossing from the bloodstream into the brain and regulating which molecules can pass through into our central nervous system. Most of the time, this is a really good thing. You don't want toxins that may be traveling in your bloodstream to be able to infiltrate your central nervous system. But it's not such a good thing when you're trying to treat something in the central nervous system, like demyelinated nerve fibers that are the result of MS. Then the blood-brain barrier stands in the way because, unfortunately, it does an equally good job of keeping potential treatments from being delivered directly to the brain. Researchers have spent a lot of time looking for ways that treatments for MS and other neurological diseases can be delivered directly to the brain, and a multinational research team may have found a way in. Those specialized cells that make up the blood-brain barrier are called endothelial cells, and the researchers were able to identify a specific protein that binds to a specific receptor in these specialized endothelial cells. And when the team blocked that protein and kept it from binding to that specific receptor in those cells, they were able to penetrate the blood-brain barrier on demand. I'll admit that this is pretty complex science, and if I tried breaking down all the details associated with this process, this would turn into a very long conversation that would still be pretty complex. But the very significant takeaway here is that if this process of blocking this protein from binding with this specific receptor in these cells, if that whole process could be engineered into a disease-modifying therapy, it would be a game changer, opening up a whole new therapeutic channel. For the first time, MS therapies could be delivered directly to the brain, which is exactly where they need to be doing their work. Now, this is still a very big if. This research was done using mice, and as I often remind you, there's a very big difference between a mouse brain and a human brain. But it's going to be exciting to see this research expand and evolve to determine whether the same outcomes can be achieved in humans. Now, if you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Many of you have heard me talk about my late wife Jean's battle with progressive MS. Unfortunately, she was given a set of profoundly disabling symptoms that progressed rapidly and aggressively. There was no treatment for progressive MS at the time, and only a handful of treatments for relapsing MS, and they really didn't seem to help her at all. Now, there was one exception to all of this, and that was a treatment called Novantron. Novantron is administered by a monthly infusion, and it turned out to be the only therapy that stopped Jean's disease progression. There was no question that she even improved a bit. Unfortunately, the downside of Novantron, and it's a significant downside, is that over time, it becomes toxic in your body. That means the amount of Novantron you can be given in your lifetime has to be strictly limited. So when Jean was prescribed Novantron, she could only take it for 11 months. No exceptions, hard stop. Not long after being taken off Novantron, we saw Jean's MS symptoms begin to worsen again. And keep in mind that when she came off Novantron, there wasn't any other disease-modifying therapy available to help her. Well, the results of a 10-year study in France indicate that initial treatment with Novantron for a period of just 3 to 6 months, followed by switching to a maintenance therapy with another DMT, led to fewer relapses and improved disability among people with highly active relapsing remitting MS. Their EDSS scores, the standard method neurologists use to quantify disability and track MS progression, those scores were actually lowered over this 10-year period. This study involved 100 people, 78 women and 22 men with highly active relapsing remitting MS. 75 of the study participants received a monthly infusion of Novantron for 3 months. The other 25 study participants received monthly infusions of Novantron for 6 months. After receiving this initial treatment with Novantron, all of the participants continued on other disease-modifying therapies. At the end of 1 year, the study participants' average annual relapse rate decreased from 2.8 relapses to 0.4 relapses per year. Nearly 3 out of 4 study participants were completely relapse-free in that first year, and average EDSS scores improved significantly. 85% of the study participants had no new lesions in that first year, and these improvements were mostly sustained over the entire 10-year study. At the end of 10 years, the average relapse rate had declined to 0.2 relapses per year, and about a quarter of the study participants hadn't had a single relapse since their Novantron treatment 10 years earlier. And remember, these study participants had been diagnosed with highly active relapsing remitting MS. The results of this study certainly make the case for early, short-term, initial treatment with a high-efficacy drug like Novantron. We'll be sure to keep you posted on future developments. And if you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. The MS Society of Canada announced that it was funding 66 new research projects designed to accelerate our understanding of multiple sclerosis and improve care for people living with MS. The projects range from research into how age-related changes in the microbiome affect progressive MS, the incidence and prevalence of mental illness during pregnancy or following childbirth, a new adaptive robotics rehabilitation approach to improving upper limb function, developing an MRI approach to assess myelin damage and MS progression, the economic burden of MS in Canada, and many, many more. The rate of scientific discovery is accelerating, and that's very promising news as we see these 66 new research projects all get started. If you'd like to review each of these projects, you'll find a link in today's show notes. The Kessler Foundation research team has published the results of a survey of the emotional outcomes of people living with MS during the COVID-19 pandemic. And those survey results reflect a large number of people living with MS who are dealing with depression and anxiety as a direct result of the pandemic. In this study, the research team surveyed 142 individuals with MS who had previously reported the status of their emotional well-being in a national online survey. The information in this previous survey allowed the researchers to see a pre-pandemic emotional baseline for each of these individuals. Now, in this new survey, The participants were asked to assess their current level of depression, anxiety, loneliness, and the perceived impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. 54% of the participants reported new depression had developed during the pandemic, and 33% of the participants reported new anxiety had developed during the same time period. Increased loneliness was reported by every participant who reported experiencing depression or anxiety. I have a strong feeling that the mental health hangover from the COVID-19 pandemic may be one of the most overlooked but lasting changes that COVID-19 has inflicted upon the world. Living with MS can be stressful and isolating all by itself. It's easy to understand how adding the additional emotional burden of spending 2 years seeing every aspect of life turned upside down could easily interrupt someone's emotional equilibrium. If you're experiencing depression or anxiety, it doesn't have to become your new normal. It's more important than ever to make sure you're practicing self-care or reaching out to a professional to get yourself back on track. There may not be a cure for MS today, but there are effective treatments for depression and anxiety. Please be sure to contact your doctor, or you can contact one of the National MS Society's MS Navigators if you're in need of a referral to someone who can help. You can reach an MS Navigator by calling 1-800-344-4867 or by email at contactusnmss@nmss.org, and you'll find that contact information in today's show notes. We've all seen or heard about a hypnotist on stage or on TV who gets people in the audience to behave in all kinds of outrageous ways. Well, there's a real question about whether what we're seeing is even hypnosis at all. The reality is that thousands of people get real treatments from trained, certified hypnotists for a variety of illnesses and ailments. Research has shown that hypnosis is an effective treatment for managing chronic pain, including the chronic pain associated with MS. And my guest, Dr. Mark Jensen, has devoted his career to developing effective treatments for pain with a focus on hypnotic interventions. In a moment, we'll meet my guest, Dr. Mark Jensen. When you think of hypnosis, the first thing that may come to mind is a stage performer having a member of the audience strut across the stage, squawking like a chicken. But despite the myths and misconceptions, hypnosis is a very real process that can be effectively used as a therapeutic tool. Joining me to talk about hypnosis and MS is Dr. Mark Jensen, a professor and vice chair of the Department of Rehabilitation Medicine at the University of Washington. Dr. Jensen has devoted his career to the development and evaluation of effective pain treatments with a focus on hypnotic interventions. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Jensen.
Happy to be here. Thanks, John.
Can you get us started with a definition of what hypnosis is and how it works?
I view hypnosis really as coming down to two parts. That is a first part in which you either recognize that you're in a state of openness to suggestion or do something to encourage that state where you are able to respond to helpful suggestions. Often that is it comes about by a person focusing their attention very much on one thing. But there are a number of ways to get into that state. Once a person either is in that state or recognizes they're in that state, you then introduce suggestions to help a person achieve their goals. And that suggestions can come from the outside, from a clinician, or from the inside, from the person themselves, in which you suggest some change in how a person feels, how they respond, their behavior. And the end result of this, for those who respond, is that the person then has a change in how they automatically respond to things. They will feel more comfortable if pain is the issue. They will eat in ways that are more healthy if eating is the issue. They might become a non-smoker if smoking is the issue. So it's a way to get at our automatic behaviors, to essentially reprogram ourselves.
And let's tackle the second part of that question. How does hypnosis work?
Well, we do research to understand that question, and it's very exciting research. It's funded by the National Institutes of Health, and we're looking at what hypnosis does to brain activity and how that's linked to the person being open to suggestion. And as it turns out, the things that we invite people to do to get their brain and mind and body in a state that's open has very specific effects on brain activity. It slows the brain down. Brain waves emerge that are associated with this focused attention and ability to remember and change things in the brain. There's also some evidence to suggest that when you use hypnosis, it decreases activity in the frontal parts of the brain that worry, that try to control things. So you're basically saying to the brain, you know what? Let go. Let's learn something new. And when the brain is ready to do that, it then can absorb ideas. If they're helpful ideas, the person will change for the better. If they're not helpful ideas, they'll change for the worse. So part of what clinical hypnosis is working with a clinician who has your best interest at heart, rather than a cult leader, for example, who might be suggesting stuff that's not so good for you.
Who's most likely to benefit from hypnosis? And is there anyone who should avoid seeking treatment by hypnosis?
So my experience is that people vary in response. Some people, it can take just a session or two and they get it. Some people it takes eight or more sessions, but virtually everybody in my experience can benefit some way from hypnosis. The difference is how much they benefit, not whether they benefit. The problems with hypnosis arise when you get the wrong clinician, a clinician who isn't trained or who doesn't have the client's best interest at heart. So a hypnosis should only be used by clinicians who are trained to treat the condition without hypnosis. So psychologists can use hypnosis to treat depression. Dentists can use hypnosis to help a person manage anxiety, dental anxiety or pain. But if somebody is just has a high school degree and isn't trained to treat, they aren't a licensed healthcare provider and trained to treat a condition, they shouldn't just learn to use hypnosis to treat, you know, dental anxiety, for example, because they're not an expert in that issue. So it's not so much not the person who shouldn't be using hypnosis, but the clinicians who shouldn't be using hypnosis. When you get a clinician who's trained with virtually any patient, the patient can benefit, my experience.
Tell us what happens in a typical hypnotherapy session.
A typical hypnosis therapy session varies from clinician to clinician because just like, you know, what's in a typical therapy session, right? But the way that I do it is I usually spend about an hour with my patients and maybe the first 15 minutes talk about how things went with the hypnosis practice. What they would like, what their goal is for today's hypnosis session, how they want to change. And then we usually do about a 20-minute hypnosis session proper, which is consistent with what I described earlier about what hypnosis is. And then following that, do essentially a debrief to talk about how was that experience, what was useful, what was less useful, and maybe talk about how the person can practice their self-hypnosis for the following week.
I want to circle back to self-hypnosis in just a moment or two, but I'm curious, sure. How many sessions does it typically take before someone sees results?
Right. So I've had patients who see results immediately, one session. I've had patients who've had, you know, 4-8 sessions. They go, well, you know what? Not so much for me. So it varies from person to person. And that's one of the fascinating things about hypnosis is the variability in outcome. But typically I see patients for 4 sessions and then evaluate at that point, you know, are we good or do we want another 4? And the majority of patients after 4 get it. They learn it and they can then go on and practice self-hypnosis to get better and better and better. One of the interesting things about hypnosis is that the outcomes continue to improve often after treatment because the person is practicing. But other patients would go, you know, I feel like I'm just getting started. Let's do another 4 to really nail this down. So I usually do 4-8 sessions.
Your research has shown that hypnosis can be an effective option for managing chronic pain. What types of pain problems are most responsive to hypnosis?
So, but in my experience, that certainly varies as a function of pain problem. So people with spinal cord injury pain, it's very refractory to treatment. About 1 in 5 report clinically meaningful decreases in their usual pain. I should add, though, that even among those who don't find clinically meaningful decreases in average pain, the majority can use hypnosis as a tool to feel better right now, like a pill. It just doesn't linger beyond a few hours. But it's harder for people with spinal cord injury. People with multiple sclerosis, it's about 50% whose kind of daily average pain decreases clinically with hypnosis. But again, most can use hypnosis to feel better right now if they want to, and it lasts for a few hours. People with phantom limb pain, about 60%, headache, 80%. But again, the side effects of hypnosis are amazing. Often people say they're sleeping better, they feel more calm. So even when they don't feel a reduction in pain intensity, they say it bothers me less. My life is better. So these are people who continue to use hypnosis, even if they don't see this large decrease in their average pain.
And this may be a related question to something you just said. I was going to ask whether you found that hypnosis is effective in managing other MS symptoms besides pain.
Absolutely. We're doing a study now funded by the National MS Society to look at the effects of hypnosis for managing fatigue. And in our pilot work, we found that it had significant effects. The people who used self-hypnosis for fatigue management liked it. They practiced with it. And so fatigue is another big one. Sleep problems. One of the big in our pilot study that looked at using this for fatigue, one of the other effects was significant improved sleep as a side effect. Basically, anything that the brain creates of our experience, you can use hypnosis for. And among the typical symptoms of people with MS, fatigue, sleep problems, pain, it definitely should be, in my view, a first-line treatment. Not something to try when other things fail, but something to work right away because the side effects are so positive.
A moment ago, you mentioned self-hypnosis. I'm curious about that. How do you train someone to hypnotize themselves?
Right. So really, it's a matter of recognizing when you're self-hypnotizing. We all go in and out of these states of openness every day. It's a natural state where the brain and mind is able to learn something new. And so what you teach people to do is recognize when it's happening, when we're in that open state, and do some tricks and things to gently nudge it along. And then when they are in that state, then give themselves self-suggestions consistent with their goals, that they will sleep very well that night and every night, that they will feel more comfort, that they will respond to food in healthy ways consistent with their health goals, that they'll just feel better. And when we get these ideas and thoughts in our head automatically, we then respond and feel better. Cognitive therapy, which some of your listeners may know about, does this through logic, you know, talking with somebody and logically challenging their beliefs. Is that really true? No? What's a better belief? With hypnosis, you go into the unconscious and you change the belief with the person's permission. And that's the key. You're using hypnosis to help a person achieve their own goals. That's clinical hypnosis, different than stage hypnosis and the hypnosis you see in movies as plot, where you're working against the person to embarrass them or worse.
Well, let's talk about some of that stuff that we see on TV and in the movies, because I think some mythology has been created around hypnosis that really misinforms us about its clinical benefits. For instance, does hypnosis cause you to forget what happened while you were hypnotized?
Many patients are very surprised at the end of a hypnosis session to say, "I remembered everything." And they say, I don't think I was hypnotized because I remembered everything. And sometimes people are so focused on the experience that they don't remember the details. But more often than not, people remember everything. Just like day-to-day function, You know, if you ask yourself, what do you remember during the day? You remember some things and not others. It's because hypnosis is not a special, unique state. It's a natural state. So you don't necessarily forget or remember more with hypnosis than you would in other states.
Well, I think I know the answer to the next question based on what you just said, but I think it's important to kind of tackle some of this head on. Hypnosis cause you to do things that you don't want to do?
Absolutely not. Hypnosis can be used to make things easier, to do things easier that you want to do. But if you do not want to do things, something, you can't be made to do it with hypnosis. So this gets back to the stage thing where, you know, the stage hypnotists pick people who have a personality that like to act out. And so the people that are doing the things on the stage are doing things consistent with what they would like to do. And so, you can't make someone do something with hypnosis that they wouldn't otherwise want to do.
What about folks who believe or say, oh, they can't be hypnotized, that hypnosis only works on people who are mentally weak or less intelligent?
The research has been done on that question, and hypnotic responding is unrelated to intelligence. So it has nothing to do with intelligence. It is associated with certain brain structure. People who are more able to respond to hypnosis more quickly have more white matter in the brain, more of the brain parts talk to each other. They have more control over their brain. Hypnosis is about self-control and self-management. And so weak-minded, no, because it takes a strong brain to be able to do this. But everybody can learn to do it in my experience. For some, it's just easier than others. I like to see view hypnosis, hypnotic ability as like a talent. Some people are just really good at it and can pick it up right away. Mozart was really pretty good at piano. He picked it up pretty quickly. Others take longer. But everybody can learn.
How can someone go about finding a hypnosis therapist? And what questions should they be asking to make sure they found the right person and not one of these folks who have not been trained as healthcare professionals?
Right. And who can legally in many states put out a shingle and say, I'm a hypnotherapist. So first of all, they shouldn't be a hypnotherapist first and foremost. They should be a clinical psychologist, a physician, a social worker, a dentist. So they should be a licensed healthcare provider. So the first question is, are you a licensed healthcare provider? They should be able to treat your condition even without hypnosis, licensed to do so. Then the question is, do they have training in hypnosis over and above that basic clinical training? And there are societies in the country who do that training, the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis, the Society of Clinical and Experimental Hypnosis. And you can go to the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis website and look for, search for people in your state who have been trained and know how to do this. The problem is, of course, at this point, it's precious few. So I've been working with some colleagues to develop a way to do this digitally, and we're developing something which we hope to get out in the months ahead. So I'll make a plug if I could.
Please do.
Okay, great. So anyone interested in learning more about that, especially as we develop it, feel free to go to the website hypnoscientific.com at hypnoscientific.com. And you can put your email in there. And then over the months, as we develop this more, we'll be getting in touch with you to let you know about it. But the idea here is that anybody can then use a digital version of this with their phone to be able to get the experience, because the need is so much greater than the availability of clinicians.
Well, I'm pretty confident that you've given my listeners some new things to consider when they're thinking about their symptom management. Tell me, what would you say to those people who may still be feeling a little reluctant to try hypnosis, or maybe they're feeling skeptical about whether hypnosis can work for them?
Yeah. So I'd first say that's a healthy thing to have. Be reluctant. Be skeptical. There are people who claim to use hypnosis out there who are potentially do you harm. These are the people who are not healthcare trained professionals. So don't go to them. And then, you know, if you're skeptical, you know, maybe hypnosis won't work for you. You may be absolutely right. Maybe it won't. At the same time, maybe it will. So if you're someone who wants to hurt less or feel less fatigued, feel more energy, if you're somebody who wants to sleep better, to change your health habits in a way that's easier, my recommendation is give it a go. Find a person who's trained and experienced and a health licensed healthcare provider. Have one session. And you may be surprised at how well you respond and how much better your life is because of it. Or you may go, yep, this didn't work for me. The side effect profile of this treatment is really good. So I think it should be a first line treatment for everything, for every condition virtually. So my suggestion is be skeptical and do it anyway.
Well, Dr. Mark Jensen, thank you for all you do to improve the quality of life for people who are living with MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me, John. Really appreciate it.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/240. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or text. If you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes, and it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.